As you look at Asia, there are a couple of bright spots, and it appears that American policy is even now beginning to diminish those. These are notably Taiwan and South Korea. Both of those nations, born of war less than three decades ago, have achieved levels of prosperity the previous generation could never have imagined. The United States, under whose military umbrella these nations have flourished, is intent on pursuing a new morality in its foreign affairs. And strangely enough, that morality involves abandoning some of America's most faithful allies in exchange for very little, or maybe nothing at all. Free Asia could be in for some momentous and far-reaching changes in the near future, and none of them augur well for the prospects of world peace. A primary concern at the moment are futures of two longtime American allies in the Far East, South Korea and the nationalist Chinese government on Taiwan. In 1961, the year of the bloodless coup which placed South Korea's President Park Chung-hee in power, the Republic of Korea's per capita GNP was a pitiful $83. By 1976, it had zoomed to a shade under $700. By 1981, it is hoped that it will rise to $1,500. But the Koreans and the Taiwanese are dogging Tokyo's heels, often irritating their big Asian rival by grabbing away business, such as supertanker construction, once thought to be a Japanese monopoly. Everywhere, the lot of the common man is steadily improving. In South Korea's capital city of Seoul, despite its precarious location just 30 miles south of the border with communist North Korea, high-rise office buildings and luxury hotels are springing skyward at furious rates. Traffic jams are becoming increasingly common as more and more automobiles take to the streets, with subway construction and highway roadwork adding to the congestion. International bankers and foreign businessmen move through the country in droves. Since 1961, more than 5 million new jobs have been created in South Korea. During the same period, South Korean exports have increased over 200 times, now standing at over $10 billion. Total foreign trade is twice that figure. By 1980, exports alone are expected to reach the $20 billion mark. South Korea's economy grew a phenomenal 15% in 1976, and when the figures are all in, the increase for 1977 is expected to range anywhere between 10 and 13%. In stark contrast, communist North Korea's economy is a shambles. Its GNP, $6 billion in 1976, is barely one quarter that of the South. Its economic performance is so poor that North Korean diplomats in Europe have reportedly been reduced to trading in black market drugs and cigarettes. Not surprisingly, the North is intensely jealous of South Korea's success and embarrassed, since the comparison between capitalism and communism is so glaring, all giving North Korean dictator Kim Il-sung yet greater temptation to attempt communizing the South by force. Since 1953, Taiwan's real gross national product has been growing at an average rate of more than 8% a year. Per capita income reached $809 in 1976, up over 9% from the previous year, and second highest in Asia after Japan. Industrial output, which has grown at an annual rate of 14% since 1953, jumped by 24% in 1976. Total trade in the same year soared nearly 40%, reaching $16 billion. Taiwan's two-way trade with the United States hit nearly $5 billion, 12 times larger than U.S. trade with mainland China. Taiwan, with an area of only 14,000 square miles, has barely over 16 million people. Communist China, with an area of 3.7 million square miles, has a population of about 850 million. Taiwan's total foreign trade volume actually exceeds that of mainland China, even though the mainland has a population over 50 times greater. Economists have often pointed to Taiwan's example as a model for developing countries. In fact, of all countries that have received U.S. economic aid, Taiwan has been one of the precious few success stories. In 1965, Taiwan became the first such country to be judged capable of guiding its own economic future, and U.S. assistance was terminated. But now, winds of change are blowing out of Washington that could upset everything. And both the Taiwanese and South Koreans fear their hard-won prosperity may be bargained away by their giant, but in their view, fickle ally across the sea.
In the face of continued movement, turn, and shift in world events, Plain Truth Magazine is pleased to offer the following compilation of articles. Big Changes Ahead in Asia. This informative reprint is available free of charge in the public interest. Plain Truth News editors conducted an extensive three-week, six-nation tour to learn, does Asia trust America? How safe is Korea? What's ahead in China and Japan? To better understand the movement, turn, and shift of world events, send for your free copy of Big Changes Ahead in Asia. Call this toll-free number, 800-423-4444. That's 800-423-4444.
Vast changes are ahead in Asia, not the least of which will be trade war between the United States and Japan, the rearmament of Japan to become a powerful conventional and nuclear force, and other changes, especially in Korea. Pick up the telephone and dial a toll-free number, 800-423-4444, for this free brochure on big changes ahead in Asia. If you live in California, Alaska, or Hawaii, it is area 213-577-5225. Well, last year, President Carter announced that the present 33,000-man U.S. ground force in South Korea would be withdrawn in stages over a five-year period. South Koreans, almost to a man, believe that the chances of war will be greatly enhanced once these U.S. forces are gone. The North Korean dictator Kim Il-sung has repeatedly called for the withdrawal of American forces ever since the Korean War ended in 1953. Why are you now doing what he, the North dictator, has demanded all along, South Koreans ask. They know that to Kim, the war of 50 to 53 was just a round one standoff. The final round, with his intended knockout blow, is yet to come. In the eyes of South Koreans, U.S. ground forces are still a necessary deterrent, discouraging North Korea from launching a war which, even if won by the South, could set the Republic's hard-won prosperity back many years. As seen from the South, the surest way to avoid war is to leave the American troops right where they are. Koreans say they make Kim think twice. As things stand now, the U.S. 2nd Infantry Division is positioned firmly astride two valleys leading to the South Korean capital of Seoul, a scant 30 miles south of the border. In launching an attack, the North Koreans would have to fight American soldiers virtually from the word go, immediately risking all-out retaliation from the U.S. military. That risk is dearly too high for North Korea. Thus, for nearly a quarter century, the strategically placed tripwire U.S. ground forces have prevented a second Korean War from breaking out. Why change a winning game, South Koreans ask today. The proposed U.S. withdrawal is based on the premise that South Korea will be able to successfully confront North Korea on its own in the event of another Korean War, and that its own forces could henceforth act as enough of a deterrent. Militarily, though, North and South Korea are considered roughly equal in up-to-date fighter planes and tanks, although the North, with much obsolete equipment, appears numerically superior on paper. Intelligence reveals that the North is being supplied with sophisticated Soviet and Chinese weaponry. For the moment, South Korea, with twice the population of the North, a slightly larger standing army, and a far stronger economic base, could probably defeat or at least stand off the North on a one-on-one confrontation. The big fear in South Korea, though, is that the North's allies, Communist China and the Soviet Union, would be forced to intervene on Kim's behalf in the event of another war. It is known that both Peking and the Kremlin have strongly counseled Kim to avoid military adventures on the peninsula. But the North Korean dictator knows he has a free hand. He's confident of the support of his two allies, however grudgingly they may have to give it. As rivals for influence throughout the communist world, Red China and the Soviet Union would be forced to competitively help Kim in a war against the South, lest one of them be accused of failing to aid a communist brother in a war of so-called liberation. Moreover, the Korean Peninsula is strategically important to both of the major communist powers, and neither Peking nor Moscow could afford to allow the other to gain the upper hand there. Thus, by playing one giant communist ally against the other, Kim would be able to enlist massive support whenever he chooses to launch his drive south. Pentagon and Defense Department officials and President Carter himself have repeatedly assured South Korea that despite the troop withdrawal, the U.S. will respond promptly to aggression against the South. A recent letter from President Carter to South Korean President Park Chung-hee assured Park that the 1954 U.S.-Korean Mutual Defense Treaty will remain firm and undiminished. And United States Defense Secretary Brown has reaffirmed that the American nuclear umbrella will continue to protect South Korea. I don't think anyone believes that the nuclear umbrella means that they would actually use nuclear weapons in the event of a war launched from the North, but at least we can speculate about that. South Koreans, though, remain unconvinced. They know the United States is still languishing in the throes of a disastrous Vietnam experience. And should the United States feel a little gun-shy, the 1954 Mutual Defense Treaty gives it a loophole by stating to the effect that each ally would act to meet the common danger in accordance with its constitutional processes. In other words, action by the Congress. The NATO Charter, by contrast, provides for unconditional American intervention. The South Koreans would like a similar ironclad assurance of immediate and automatic assistance from the United States in case of war, without prolonged congressional haggling, because they think shades of Angola about whether or not to send the troops back. Once American troops are gone, it is clear that getting them back would require one of the most drastic military decisions the United States has confronted since World War II. Should the United States opt to re-enter the area and intervene against a Soviet ally, Soviet-American relations might well deteriorate, at least to the level of the 1962 Cuban Missile Crisis. And Russia is much stronger now. Horrible as it may sound, the U.S. would probably justify sacrificing an ally, one of 35 million people, rather than risk an all-out nuclear bomb World War III. Furthermore, even if U.S. ground troops were immediately sent back to Korea from other bases in Asia, the North Koreans, with only 30 miles separating the border from Seoul, would very likely overrun the South Korean capital before the Americans arrived. Military analysts estimate that a massed armor attack launched at night would have a good chance of reaching Seoul by dawn, even against American Air Force opposition. That's why one official after another in South Korea urges the United States to keep its small but strategically pinpointed ground forces right where they are, so there won't be any aggression to respond to. Overall, South Koreans believe the gains of withdrawal are non-existent, but the risks of withdrawal are enormous. Perhaps the strangest thing about the current situation there is that practically no power, directly or indirectly involved in the ageless dispute, wants to change the status quo, except for North Korea. No one, again, wants to see the American troops leave, except for the men in Pyongyang, and that includes the Russian and the Chinese, as strange as that may sound. The Soviet Union sees no advantage whatever in the U.S. troop withdrawal if that means war and a communized Korea, because Moscow knows that a Korea under Red control would more likely lean toward Peking. And by being forced to aid Kim Il-sung in a war, Soviet detente with the United States would come to an end. A communist victory in Korea, moreover, would send shockwaves throughout Japan and would inevitably lead to an abrupt change in Japan toward rearmament. The Russians, who have enough trouble on their hands with China, would not like to worry about Japan, too. Communist China, likewise, has no interest at this time in upsetting the apple cart in Korea. In China's eyes, the United States must remain a credible power in Asia if the emerging relationship between the two is to develop. If the United States shows itself to be no more than a paper tiger by abandoning an ally in that area, Peking may feel compelled to mend its fences with a real tiger, which is in Moscow. Thus, for both the Soviets and the Chinese, the American presence can be a stabilizing force on the Korean Peninsula. And contrary to their public statements, Moscow and Peking are not excited about the U.S. withdrawal. And the last thing they want at this time is a recurrence of the Korean conflict. In spite of these consequences, America still appears determined to abandon Korea, a key ally in the Far East.
Plain Truth, the International Publication of Understanding. Plain Truth, information you need in today's changing society. Plain Truth. Correspondents in all quarters of the globe report on current trends. For your free subscription to the monthly Plain Truth Magazine, call toll-free 800-423-4444. That's 800-423-4444.
Pick up the telephone and dial a toll-free number for your current copy of the Plain Truth Magazine that goes behind the scenes in world conditions like these we're discussing on this and other programs and tells you not only what's happening, but what it means in the light of Bible prophecy. The Plain Truth is yours if you pick up the telephone and dial 800-423-4444. If you live in California, Alaska, or Hawaii, it's area 213-577-5225. The Republic of China, Taiwan, lies only 100 miles off the coast of the communist mainland. And in the eyes of many of Taiwan's 16 million inhabitants, the character writing is on the wall. The reason? Well, Taiwan, long a faithful ally of the United States, stands as the chief obstacle in Washington's drive for closer relations with communist China. It's a strange world we live in, isn't it? The United States now apparently has embarked upon a clear course to come to terms with Peking. When that happens, the nationalists will lose their last major ally and only real protector. And they would be left alone should the communists ever decide to force a so-called final solution to the China problem. The Carter administration would like to find a way to grant full diplomatic recognition of the communist dictatorship on the Chinese mainland, recognizing it as the sole legitimate government of China. But Peking has set three requirements which Washington must meet before such relations could be established. First, withdrawal of U.S. diplomatic recognition from Taiwan. Second, termination of the 1954 Mutual Security Treaty between Washington and Taipei. And third, withdrawal of the remaining U.S. troops from Taiwan. These terms say the communist Chinese are not negotiable. The establishment of diplomatic relations must be on their terms or not at all. In return for these concessions, Washington would presumably acquire greater leverage against Moscow in the international game of detente and prevent Peking from seeking and reconciling with the Soviets. But as for our Chinese allies on Taiwan, the implications would be very disastrous. The flurry of American diplomatic activity toward Peking in the last 6 years has puzzled many on Taiwan. Why is your country changing a winning game? The Chinese ask. They feel that Washington has little to gain but much to lose by recognizing Peking and de-recognizing the Republic of China. First, it would be the first time a nation friendly to the United States would be denied recognition. Taiwan has proved to be a long-standing, tested, and faithful ally of the United States. During World War II, Chiang Kai-shek refused Japan's offer of a separate peace and continued to hold at bay over 2 million Japanese who otherwise would have been fighting Americans in the Western Pacific. During the Vietnam War, Taiwan made ground facilities available to the United States. The Chinese on Taiwan find it difficult to reconcile the Carter administration's pledge to restore morality to American international affairs with its plans to abandon free China and recognize the communist regime in Peking, an oppressive 1984-type government, which is about as immoral as they come, and which, according to reliable records, massacred more than 60 million people after its occupation of the mainland in 1949. Moreover, Peking, as recent news dispatches reveal, continues to employ political executions in dealing with enemies. Recognizing Peking in the face of its deplorable human rights record, Taiwanese feel, would represent a flagrant betrayal of American moral principles and a betrayal of the cause of freedom. George Yi, who as Taiwan's foreign minister signed the U.S.-Taiwan Defense Pact in 1954, stated recently that recognizing Peking would, and I quote him, mean a clearly political demonstration in favor of communist rule. American history, he pointed out, has no parallel to this act of support given toward the suppression of human rights. End of quote. It would certainly deal a severe blow to the morale of the Taiwanese people, to say nothing of placing a huge damper over the Republic as an area of safe, sure economic investment. Despite such pleas, many Taiwanese privately feel that moral arguments of this nature are unlikely to dissuade President Carter's foreign planners. Complicating matters is the U.S.-Taiwan Mutual Defense Treaty of 1954, which obligates America to intervene on the side of the nationalists should Peking launch an offensive against Taiwan. This poses perhaps the most difficult problem to resolve before Washington will be able to push forward toward full relations with Peking. The treaty is of a permanent nature, containing no termination date. It can only justifiably be terminated after 1 year's notice if one of the parties repeatedly fails to live up to the terms of the agreement. The problem for Washington is that Taiwan has been a completely faithful ally through the 22 years of the treaty. It's conscientiously fulfilled all its obligations under the pact, As a result, the U.S. has no legal grounds for renouncing the treaty. How to unilaterally invalidate its clear defense obligations poses a difficult problem for Washington. If the United States were to go back on its commitment to Taiwan, then what do other allies who have similar treaties in their files think about it? What would the word of the United States then be worth? What would be the impact upon Australia and New Zealand? What about Japan, the Philippines, Israel, and the NATO alliance? American credibility could suffer a blow from which it might never recover, not only in the eyes of its allies, but also in the eyes of its enemies. On the other hand, if the U.S. nevertheless decides to push ahead with the recognition of Peking and abrogate its defense pact with Taiwan, would Peking really try to take Taiwan by force? The Taiwanese reply, of course, and they will move much quicker than you think. Why? Well, a swift takeover of Taiwan, they believe, would greatly enhance Peking's role as a world power and give her increased stature in the eyes of fellow communists the world over. In addition, Peking would have to act before the Kremlin could reach a counterbalancing rapprochement with Taiwan, a deal the Soviets would undoubtedly attempt to make. Moscow would clearly love to establish a foothold on the strategic island, which would enable them to cover the entire southeast flank of communist China. Despite these considerations, Secretary of State Vance has repeatedly stated that the United States expects Peking and Taiwan to resolve their differences peaceably. President Carter has said that the goal of the United States policy is normalization of relations with Peking, as well as a peaceful life for the Taiwanese. According to Taiwan's Foreign Minister Shen Changhuan, the peaceful settlement theme being harped on by the Chinese communists is only an attempt on their part to forcibly impose their tyranny on the 16 million Chinese on Taiwan. For these reasons, the foreign minister says that the government of the people and Republic of China will in no circumstances enter into any negotiation with the Chinese communists. Taiwanese emphasize that however much the United States may talk of hoping for and expressing interest in a peaceful settlement, such flowery sentiments will not change Peking's ironclad determination to liberate, as they put it, Taiwan by force of arms. Only the defense pact, they say, can prevent otherwise certain communist aggression. And these are not just the words of the nationalist Chinese. In a speech delivered in Peking last August, just 10 days before Vance's visit to Peking last year, Communist China's chairman Hua Kuo-Fung declared quite recently, or quite clearly, "We are determined to liberate Taiwan. When and how," he said, "is China's affair." And one of China's vice premiers stated a month earlier that as to when and in what way the Chinese people are to liberate their sacred territory of Taiwan is entirely China's internal affair, which brooks no interference from other countries. The mutual defense treaty between the United States and the Republic of China has served to preserve peace in the Western Pacific during the last 20 years, and there's no doubt that so long as it remains in force, it will continue to serve that purpose. Without it, war across the Formosa Strait is a virtual certainty, and it will be a bloody one. The Taiwanese, determined, well-armed with a powerful air force, could put up a valiant defense. But how long can 16 million withstand 850 million should Peking relentlessly push for victory, no matter its losses? Many Taiwanese see Washington's seemingly irrational policy of pursuing relations with Peking on Peking's terms as a policy of appeasement, a policy which will encourage communist Chinese aggression, in the same fashion, Neville Chamberlain's appeasement of Hitler encouraged Nazi aggression. But as many American political observers have pointed out, there's no need for the United States to appease China. The conventional wisdom is that the U.S. concessions are needed to keep communist China from mending its fences with Russia. But I think veteran columnist George Will succinctly summarized the fallacy in that reasoning. "There is no evidence," he recently wrote, and I quote his words, "that China, if unappeased, will turn its policy inside out and seek rapprochement with the Soviet Union. Either China needs closer relations with America to counter the Soviet threat, or it doesn't. If it does, it needs those relations more than it needs to humiliate America over Taiwan. If China doesn't need close relations with America, America can't purchase close relations with China by abasing itself and sacrificing a small nation." In short, what would the U.S. get out of formal Peking recognition that it doesn't already have? Nothing, he said. Actually, within the framework of Oriental ethics, a craven yielding to Peking's demands for scuttling Taiwan, though it might serve Peking's purpose, would also earn Peking's contempt. Abandoning an ally, even though it be Taiwan, would be a demeaning loss of face, terribly important in the Orient. A loss of face for the United States before the Chinese and all the Oriental world, and America would end up in a far worse state. American officials have already bowed and scraped quite a good deal in cultivating relations with Peking. During the last 5 years, in addition to Cyrus Vance's trip, there were 9 visits by Henry Kissinger to China, and 2 American presidents made the trek to Peking. Meanwhile, not one important Chinese official has bothered to visit Washington. That ought to afford some insight as to how much we have to gain from Peking by sacrificing Taiwan. More than any other part of the world, East Asia, through the spectacular success stories of Japan, the Republic of Korea, and the Republic of China, demonstrate how peace and prosperity can be achieved in a free world in which America has provided leadership. But now, all this is changing. The prospect of renouncing of Taiwan, along with a troop pullout from South Korea, are both a part of the growing picture of U.S. retreat from Asia, a policy which could well prove to be gross miscalculation with far-reaching implications for the United States and the world at large. In effect, the U.S. ground forces have served as the finger in the dike of peace in Korea and all of Northeast Asia. When they're removed, a flood of tensions is bound to rise. Wars and rumors of wars, just like it says in Matthew 24, to watch for in today's world news, will threaten in that part of the world like they have for so long, in Africa, the Middle East, and other parts of the world. And the temptation on the part of both North and South Korea to go nuclear will intensify. Also, consider Japan, the free world's second largest economy. It could begin a military buildup as a result of the new Korean situation. Japanese doubts about American trustworthiness may force Tokyo into drastically hiking its defense expenditures to bolster its present 200,000-man self-defense forces. Such rearmament would almost certainly cause anxiety all around the world, especially Asia, other nations there who remember Japanese wartime aggression. Think of what Japanese rearmament would mean to the Philippines and to New Zealand and Australia. In addition, United States' folly in Asia will likely make waves a continent away in Western Europe, where some politicians can't help but wonder if American timidity extends beyond Korea and Taiwan. So American actions in Asia can be understood in only one context, that of the steady worldwide erosion of American power and influence. A nation in retreat when it doesn't need to be. A nation in decline when it shouldn't be. With a government that apparently is having difficulty distinguishing between friend and foe, a people that has lost its moorings to its own history and to a God that gave it national blessings beyond those of any other people in all of history. If Washington turns a deaf ear to the pleas of Asian allies, then all of Asia could be heading into a time of unparalleled instability, eventually culminating in war, destruction, and suffering, and the dramatic loss of influence and moral might from which a decaying America might never recover.
For the free literature offered on this program, write Garner Ted Armstrong, Pasadena, California, 91123. In Canada, Box 44, Vancouver, BC. Or in the continental United States, you may call this toll-free number, 800-423-4444. That's 800-423-4444. In California, dial direct, 213-577-5225. All literature is free upon request.